I'm Christopher Lydon with Joey Ito. He has just inherited the 25-year-old fantasy factory known as the MIT Media Lab, where the digital revolution was, in a real sense, hatched. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. If the internet dream could take human form, it might well look and sound like this boyish, cheerful, 44-year-old Joey Ito, a techie, an investor, a connector who gives other futurists courage. Joey Ito is like the web, everywhere and nowhere. He's Japanese in Japan, but he's deeply American, too, in experience and self-education. And now he's taken up another residence in Dubai just to get the feel of the Middle East. At the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we're talking about his mission well into this digital age of saving the internet from commercialism, from over or under regulation, from its own transformative success. Joey Ito, it's almost 10 years ago that you and I recorded our first conversation in the pearly dawn of the blogosphere. So my first big picture question in 2011 with you at the Media Lab is, how do you like your digital utopia so far? And what's your vision of where it's going?
So it's not a utopia. And I've been criticized for being utopian, but I don't think I am.
Utopia in the old Greek root doesn't mean the best place or a good place. It means no place.
No place. We're someplace. I'm not sure exactly where we are on the curve yet. But as with most things, I think we've all over-anticipated the short term and under-anticipated the long term. I think that a lot of what we were talking about 10 years ago is happening now. And I think that, you know, Twitter lowered the bar for engagement to people who would normally write a blog post tweet. And I think we see a lot of the effects through Twitter that we had hoped that the blogosphere would do. And
what are the good ones that you see?
I think, you know, the fundamentally important thing that happened and is happening in the Middle East is routing around any ability for governments to spend billions of dollars and suppress information. You know, they just these regimes have been for decades investing in security, and they're unable to, even in some of the most well-controlled places, prevent citizens from speaking up, from sharing information. And I think that that's extremely significant. And WikiLeaks is one aspect of it. You know, I think that Twitter in Egypt is another element of that. But we have a lot of tools. We also now have much higher penetration and proliferation of devices that people can use to read and write and speak to the internet. And I think that, you know, a lot of the things we were talking about in emergent democracy, many elements of that are becoming reality.
Can I just push back a little bit? I mean, yes, people have tools to connect, to link, to feel empowered, to share information, to get information, but governments have more power to surveil, in some places to control. Certainly in Egypt, it's still a military regime, and they know more about who's in Tahrir Square than they ever would have known 10 years ago.
Yes.
But in China, they have completely thwarted whatever democratic impulse is built into the web.
Yeah, I don't know if I would use the word completely.
I wouldn't either. I want to take that back. Yeah, for the moment.
You know, and I think, you know, protests and things come in swells. If you look in the newspaper today, Syria is still fighting against a regime that, you know, no one thought would be able. No one thought it would get this far. And I think you're right. I think there are more tools to surveil. There are more tools to control than there ever have been. But I think the key factor about the empowerment that's happening is not just the information, it's the courage that people have, the courage that you get when you realize that your voice is being heard, you realize that people are watching. And this isn't just the internet. I think one of the key pieces for Egypt was Al Jazeera, having the cameras there. You know, Wada, the director general of Al Jazeera, was talking when he gave his talk at TED about how, you know, a young man called him from Tahrir Square and said, don't turn the cameras off because that's the only thing protecting us from being shot. You know, and so, you know, good old-fashioned TV also is playing a role, but it's the relationship between the social media and the television and everything else that's providing the courage for people to go out. And especially, you know, some places obviously violence is erupting, but overwhelmingly there's more nonviolent protest. And again, this is just people going out, realizing that other people are out there. And I think that that's one trick that the government can't do anymore, which is this kind of divide, separate, and make people feel like they're alone.
You know, I'd almost forgotten that you live in Dubai now,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
I want you to reintroduce yourself in a sense, Joey. I think of you as this guy who is very Japanese culturally, very, very sophisticated about American culture too, up on technology, up on finance. I think of you as sort of living at 30,000 feet in a sort of year-round Davos conference with your people online too. Where are you nowadays? You discovered scuba diving and the World of Warcraft. I'd love you to explain that. But are you still kind of in this cloud of conversation eternally with folk out there on the web?
I am. I when I took over the CEO position of Creative Commons, one of my jobs was to manage and expand our network of affiliates in over 70 countries. And one of the regions that we had relationships but didn't have that much traction was the Middle East. We had a relationship with Library of Alexandria. We had a relationship with Al Jazeera. And when I went to visit to try to get more adoption of Creative Commons, more adoption of the internet in the Middle East, I realized that...
Explain Creative Commons, which we love. It's this kind of notion of sharing without tight copyright.
Yeah, it's Creative Commons is a free content license that allows you to put a legal and technical code onto your content to tell people how they can share it. YouTube just announced you can now choose a Creative Commons license when you upload a video to YouTube. But people who use our licenses are people like Al Jazeera uses it, the White House uses it, TED videos are Creative Commons licensed, Wikipedia is Creative Commons licensed. It's for content that wants to be shared rather than
right.
open source. And you know, the Arab world has very little content online, and they hadn't adopted the Creative Commons license. And I felt that for the region and also for the rest of the world, you know, getting Arab content online was important. And when I visited, I realized that the culture was so different. I grew up with, you know, lots of Jewish friends, lots of Christian friends, lots of Buddhist friends. I grew up between U.S. and Japan, spent a lot of time in Europe. But the Arab world was completely different. I didn't understand it at all. And as somebody who feels that diversity is very important and that I learned the best when I'm knocking myself out of my comfort zone, moving to the Middle East and spending a substantial amount of time there, I realized was an important part of filling one of my blind spots that I had discovered. But I've been spending a lot of time. I went to, you know, Ramallah, I went to Syria, Lebanon, you know, we'll be going to Tunisia at the end of the month. Last week I was just in Qatar, and every month I spend, you know, a week or so in various Arab countries. But for me, so to get back to your question about this connectedness, so the great thing about the internet is because you can connect with everybody, but the face-to-face is essential. And so I travel around the world now once or twice every month, visiting usually Singapore, Japan, Dubai, and now Boston, with other countries sort of sprinkled in every time I go around. And, you know, I use the internet to connect to those people. But also, as I develop communities, I pull those people into my online communities. And but the online and the real world and the online world are becoming exceedingly much more meshed. I think mobile's helping it a lot. I think that the availability of access is helping a lot. There are very few places in the world where at least somebody isn't online.
Have you reached that point when you want to scream, just only disconnect, just unplug the damn thing?
Well, that's my diving. So we can't, there's no talking underwater, at least not, I don't use these intercom things. So diving is great. There's no internet and there's very little talking and there's a lot of focus and a lot of water.
And beautiful fish.
Yes, I try to do that once a week or so, if I can, as I go diving as a way to kind of take a little break from being online. And in the Middle East, it's interesting because it's so hot that diving is kind of the Gulf of the Middle East. So a lot of you go diving with, you know, your business associates and your friends.
Explain World of Warcraft.
So World of Warcraft, I guess I started it after we had our last conversation. It was I had been playing a lot of these multi-user games. That was how I actually got interested in the internet. The internet, to me, originally when I was in high school, was a way to access online games. And I hadn't played the World of Warcraft at the beginning because it seemed to me that it wasn't enough user-generated content, which was the kind of games that I like, were the games made by the players. But once I got in, I realized that the social aspect of World of Warcraft was great. And there are a couple of elements. First of all, unlike a chat room, you have a shared activity where you're building things together. And because you have scarcity and you have quests and you have all kinds of structure around the interaction, you're doing an activity, shared activity together. You're not just sitting around and talking, mm-hmm. Which is a critical part in creating this sort of substrate for a deep community. The other really important thing about the World of Warcraft is that it's so well designed that you don't have to be literate to play. And it's very broad, that category of people who play. So, for instance, Second Life is interesting, but the right. people who play Second Life, the fact that 80% of them create objects isn't that 80% of all people in the world can create objects. It's that they attract the kind of people who can write software. Whereas World of Warcraft is very working class, military. So I run a World of Warcraft guild. You know, we have soldiers deployed to Iraq. We have a priest. We have a rabbi. We have Arabs. We have Chinese. We have Japanese. We have 5-year-old kids. We have CEOs, and we all play together. Mm-hmm. And the Reverend was telling me, it feels like a church congregation where people come together. They have a shared activity. You're like a family, And people really care for each other, and we all meet in real life and support each other in real life. And it's a very interesting study in community building. But the other thing that I think that's really important, this is a John Seely Brown idea, mm-hmm. who used to run Zurich Spark, is a simulator is something that looks a lot like exactly what you're trying to learn. A case study is a simulation of what it feels like to be a CEO, probably. World of Warcraft is a metaphor, right? So when you're running a guild, or if you're running a raid to go and take on a huge boss monster, and you're on the speakers and you're leading this group, it has nothing to do with running a company, but it is metaphorically much more like being the CEO of a company than reading a case study about being a CEO of a company. And so John Seely Brown makes a distinction of this kind of metaphorical learning. And so if you see the kids in our guild that learn about leadership, that learn about social behavior by mm-hmm. being in the guild, or you see, you also see, we have MBAs who join the guild and think that they can lead, and they realize that no one will follow them. You know, whereas you'll find some of the people who come from occupations that involve listening, like night shift nurses and bartenders, tend to be better leaders, I find, than the MBAs. You know, and so to me, that's also fascinating, because there's a lot of interesting metaphorical learning going on that I think people don't appreciate.
Joe Ito, come back to some of the big reservations about where the internet is going. We spoke of this sort of stalemate between surveillance and expression. But there's another anxiety out there among a lot of the deep believers. I'm thinking Larry Lessig, for example, or Jonathan Zittrain. But Doc Searles put it to me very succinctly the other day that the internet world is being enclosed by government, by corporations, by regulation of all kinds, and that in effect we have a combination of the entertainment industry and the phone companies to put a television set in your pocket and sell you things, a lot of things you don't need either. Mm-hmm. But is it part of the MIT Media Lab's assignment and yours in the next few years to steer us out of that cul-de-sac? Or do you believe that that's a real problem?
So I think that the battle of keeping the internet open has been there from the very beginning. I remember when I was helping to set up the first commercial internet service provider in Japan and ran it for a while, everyone tried to destroy us. They didn't like that the phone companies weren't in charge. They didn't like that anyone could participate. Mm. Lawyers in Japan, professors said that it was illegal. NTT, the phone company at the time, said that, you know, ADSL would break ISDN, that some of my friends even got death threats. You know, this opening of the network, allowing people to hack. This was a tremendously political thing. And it continues to be a political thing. And it was a very political thing, bringing in packet switching at the network layer. And then it was a very political thing trying to get the web and content open. And then it's a very political thing at the copyright layer with Creative Commons.
Right. They're among the other bad guys, the copyright hawks.
But it's always going to be the people who are incumbent, who like central planning, who like control. And so there'll always be a struggle between those who want control because they're in charge and those who want to have access because they're not in charge. And the struggle between central planning and distributed open versus closed has always existed, will always exist.
But which way is it trending? I mean, the Lessigs of the world think we're in trouble.
You know, so I'm an optimist. I tend to believe that things generally get better slowly, although it swings back and forth. Having said that, I believe you have to continue to fight. So I'm always fighting to try to keep the internet open. And, you know, it's a relentless battle that always continues. And so I don't believe it's getting worse. But I mean, all the stuff going on in the Middle East for me is a great sort of positive effect of this that wouldn't have happened otherwise, but having said that, I'm not naive. I think that we'll go through periods that are going to be tremendously difficult. Japan is a terrible place in many ways because a lot of the traditional types, like the students, for instance, aren't fighting for freedom of the internet. They're kind of passive. You know, there was a survey done at one of the universities that I work with. They asked the students who they thought should run the internet, and they said the police, which it was a scary thought.
The students said that.
And I think you asked about the Media Lab. I think the Media Lab hasn't been a player in this, lack of a better word, the battle. You know, the Media Lab so far doesn't use that much Creative Commons, that doesn't use, you know, has some open source, but isn't that involved in open courseware and things like that. So that's one thing I think that I'll be bringing in with my DNA.
Joe Ito, in what sense are you offering yourself as a model of a kid who dropped out of college not once but twice and who sort of fled when they said, forget your intuition, learn what the book says?
Yesterday was commencement at MIT, and the day before I spoke to some of the kids graduating from the Media Lab, and the question of me being a dropout and then running the lab keeps coming up. And I assured the parents and the students that if I had been at the Media Lab, I would have graduated. and I think what's really important is there are different kinds of learners. My sister and I were brought up with very similar privileges, very similar background, obviously, but she went on and became straight-A student, Harvard magnum cum laude, 2 PhDs, and was very content in the formal education process. It didn't work for me. I'm what she calls an interest-driven learner. And I like projects, I like tinkering, I learn through doing, and I learn through talking to people. And the Media Lab is the perfect place for that kind of learner. You know, it's more about making things, it's multidisciplinary, it's exactly the kind of place that I wish I had had. Mm. And, you know, I think that even outside of formal education, you have kids who are teaching each other things. You know, in the World of Warcraft, this is a great example of peer-to-peer teaching. I mean, you first are teaching about the game, but then the conversation starts to drift and people are teaching each other about physics and math and things like that. And so there's certain group of people, which I would argue is a small percentage of people, who do very well in formal education. I think most of us have a hard time in formal education. And I really would like the Media Lab to be, it already is the perfect place for the informal learner, but to get here you have to be somewhat good at formal learning. But I'd love the Media Lab to become an example, a pilot, for how we do what we call interest-driven learning, you know, learning through making, and then start to disseminate that DNA to other institutions, to other places. You know,
what would it mean practically for, you know, UCLA or University of Chicago or University of Michigan, for that matter?
I mean, well, you know, I think one important thing is that when you have a tissue scientist and an economist and a computer science student sitting around, and if they're trying to talk to each other with words or with papers, it's very difficult because their domain language is so different. But when they sit down and decide they need to build something together, then suddenly it becomes very real and very rigorous in its own way. And building something and making things is a very good way of, and this is the DNA of the internet. You know, the Internet Engineering Task Force, their motto is rough consensus running code. So instead of these large intergovernmental agencies who sit around for years trying to anticipate every single problem, making a specification that's, you know, a mile high that only a big research institution can build, the internet is all about writing a little snippet of code, working on it. I mean, David Weinberger has a great phrase, small pieces loosely joined.
Right.
Well, building something is a really great way to suddenly become very practical, very concrete, and then you can get around it. And having that thing allows a whole bunch of different disciplines to sit around and talk about something practical. And so building, I think, and making is a very important way, one, to learn, but also to create this kind of interdisciplinary environment. And I think the interdisciplinary environment is critical because I think that a lot of the problems, the complexity of the world that we have today, both from a cultural diversity perspective, but a diversity of the different sorts of things that are involved in the problem and the solution, require us to break these traditional boundaries. And I think that the sort of long-termness of the Media Lab, but also the agility of the Media Lab, comes from this very practical, let's just build it and figure it out as we go along kind of thing, which is very much part of the internet DNA. And if you think about the problem with the world, most of the problems that we have today, I mean, it's a very cliche as a black swan, are all these problems that aren't planned, aren't anticipated. Just about every solution, just about every problem is only obvious in retrospect. And, you know, John C. Lee Brown has this great book, The Power of Pull, and he talks about how you should pull the resources as you need them. Don't stock them. Don't centrally plan things. Don't, you know, and he says, chart a trajectory and then embrace serendipity as you go along and pull the things as you need them. And I think that's the way that you survive in a complex and ever-changing society and continue to be agile, is to sort of pull things as you need them and build things as you need them. And I think that DNA of embracing serendipity, this whole place is about serendipity. It's when the tissue scientist sits next to the AI guy and says, hey, we should start a project, we should collaborate. And so when you, to answer your question, I think this kind of maker-driven, serendipity-friendly, interdisciplinary lab atmosphere and support system is critical. And I think everybody needs to have this. And in companies, you can do this. I think the 20% time, 10% time idea that allows people to work outside of their domain, those are all really important tools. And even in journalism, I think, you know, having a couple of software engineers in the newsroom is critical.
Amen. And you remind me of the moment when Dave Weiner and I met at the Berkman Center. He said, you know radio, I know syndication, RSS. What the world needs is a syndicatable MP3 file. Let's do it. And he knew infinitely more about it than I did. But it's a couple of months later, we had the podcast, the first podcast, and it was only 03.
Yes.
Only, what, 8 years ago?
It's like the proverbial Reese's Peanut Butter Cup commercial. I mean, it's just, you just have to...
Let's hear it. How did it go?
It's when the guy is walking down the hall with the chocolate and the peanut butter, and they bump into each other, and you get the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. You have to have that more and more intentionally occur, because the problem with society today is with specialization, with scale, that the David Weiners and the Chris's don't meet as much as they should.
Mm. Joy, what do you make of the fact that in the short term anyway, the internet has been hugely destructive of media, as we used to define it, of institutions like the New York Times and the papers, Sirius Network News, local journalism. The internet has made all of those enterprises kind of unprofitable. Mm-hmm. And we miss them.
Yes, I miss them too. But, you know, we don't make pyramids anymore either. You know, sometimes some things just don't work anymore from a business model perspective. But I will say, for instance, that this is not my metaphor, but some people use this. It's great. Which is, a video game industry went from selling little CDs with content to a subscription model involving no not having to deal with copyright issues, going to online games. I mean, they started out with actually consoles, and then they went into CDs, and then they went into subscriptions. And the video game industry seems to be very good at continuing to reinvent itself and shift from one revenue model to the next. You know, you have a lot of video game companies that have gone out of business and haven't been able to keep up, but you still have video games making tons of money. And in fact, you know, some of the video games today dwarf the biggest movies in terms of revenue. I think Call of Duty, the last one, made $1 billion. And so, to me, it's a lot has to do with the inability to innovate. You know, I think that the music industry could have gone there. They were going with karaoke, and then they kind of didn't move to the next step. They didn't go interactive. They didn't figure out a network model. My main fear about the media industry is that the people, the journalists, the people who know media the best, aren't equipped, aren't sitting around thinking about the business model in a creative way.
What worries me about the media is that when you compare, say, the online New York Times to even the printed edition today, not to mention the printed edition of 20 years ago, there's no question that the online temptation is to go celebrity, sensation, not naked girls on page three, but in that direction.
But I do think, though, that it's the big media companies like the AOL Time Warners that took things like CNN and said, you're a pile of content that we're going to sell. And to me, personally, you know, these big media companies are ripping the heart and soul of journalism out of the media. And at the same time, you find these kids marching in Tahrir Square, you know, using Twitter. They're all about journalism.
Right.
So people are saying, well, this doesn't sell. It may not sell to the people that you think are your market, but now more than ever, activism, information journalism, that's the stuff, that's the heart and soul of what people are willing to pay for. And I think that these big guys who started looking at journalism as if it were pieces of content to sell with the pictures of the girls and all this other stuff, I just think that they don't get where the value is. And so, again, I don't have the answer. If I did, I'd be doing it. But I think that we need a lot of innovation, but we really need to sort of boil it down to what is it that journalism is? Who should be funding it? And you know, and there are a lot of different models. I mean, I think that, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be a private enterprise. You know, I think that, you know, I'm on the board of the Mozilla Foundation. It's a nonprofit Mozilla Foundation, and we make Firefox. You know, we make money, we have programmers, we change the world, but we don't have any shareholders. So it doesn't mean that it has to be a for-profit enterprise. Al Jazeera is a good example of a state-run enterprise that does a pretty good job at journalism. You know, and they do a lot of stuff online. So I think we have to be flexible. I do think it's a problem. I do think that taking journalism out of the professional journalists out of the picture comes at a great cost. But I think that, you know, counting on these big public media conglomerates to figure it out is not where it's going to be figured out.
Well said, Joe Ito. Thank you so much, and good luck with the whole project.
Thank you, Chris.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.